This is Dissecting Dragons, a speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers.
Hello, and welcome to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeleine Vaughan.
And I'm Jules Ironside. This week, the F word revisited, fairies in urban fantasy.
So it's finally here.
It is finally here. In fact, before we get onto the bit that you're actually excited about, we should say that we've reached our 200th episode.
We have. We've reached 200. Jules, you and I have sat down 200 times.
Actually, we've sat down more than that because we've had a couple of episodes that just haven't worked.
Yeah, that's true, where there have been recording issues or problems in general. So we've done more than 200 episodes, but these are 200 episodes aired.
Yes.
It's incredibly exciting. I'm sort of geeking out about it.
The fact that we are still going, still finding things to talk about, and there doesn't seem to be any sign of slowing down so far, so yeah, a small pat on the back occasion for us.
Definitely. So because it is 200 episodes, Jules has decided that I'm allowed to use the F word today, and that we're going to talk about fairies. I should point out that it's not that Jules is adverse to fairies. She's very knowledgeable on them. She has a lot of interest in them. But she has what we like to call self-control. And I don't. So today is kind of like a bit of a fanfare for me. I'm incredibly excited, little bit fanatical, that we're going to be talking all about fairies. So let's get into it.
Well, see, the way I see it was, and in the notes I actually put, why are we doing this episode? Because Madeleine needs to talk about fairies. The way I see it is, Madeleine is a one-woman fairy talking machine, and once you set her off, she cannot be bought, she cannot be reasoned or bargained with, and she absolutely will not stop until she reaches her objective. Kind of like the Terminator.
Yeah, I think that that's a fair description. And so many people have been left confused, scared and upset by my insistence that we talk about fairies. So to actually have permission is novel.
See, this is why we structure an episode and say, right, this time have at it. and then you're kind of on the F-jar ban again for a bit after that.
Yeah, I just get to kind of get it out of my system a little bit. The problem is that it replenishes in my system very quickly, so
this is true. So anyway, we're bleeding off from the dam a little bit today, and it is an interesting topic, and we've decided to look at it specifically from the angle of urban fantasy, because I think fairies are some of the most ubiquitous creatures used in urban fantasy, certainly modern urban fantasy. Possibly they're topped out by, I was going to say dinosaurs, I don't mean dinosaurs, I mean vampires. My brain is just completely misfired. There are dinosaurs. Let me say dinosaurs.
Is this
something I need to talk about dinosaurs?
Yeah. Do you want to talk about dinosaurs, Jules?
Always, pretty much. But anyway, yeah. So back to fairies. Fairies turn up in urban fantasy an awful lot, and it's an interesting angle to come at. Basically, why is urban fantasy so uniquely adapted to fairies? Mm. And the way I thought about it was the fact that fairies have always been part of that. So what we say of urban fantasy now, that's fantasy in a modern setting that may be urban or in fact may be rural, but with modern people, and then this other world sort of brushing up against it. Well, historically, all fairy lore and all folk tales that have featured fairies are technically kind of urban fantasy for that particular era.
Yeah.
I mean, I know we don't talk about them that way, but all the old folklore and fairy lore, where we're talking about someone disappearing under a mound and then coming, turning up 100 years later or what have you, that is technically the urban fantasy of that historical period.
Yeah.
So they've always gone hand in hand with this modern idea of fantasy, the world as we see it and this other world that brushes up against it. That's why I think the two sort of fit hand in glove.
Yeah. And I think it's not just that this is the case for, you know, folklore back in the day being of the era. It's also still in the modern day, because belief in fairies, or at the very least, traditions to do with fairies, still continue to exist in the modern day on, you know, quite a high level, considering, in that pretty much everybody has got, you know, whether you believe in them or not, you go to Ireland and everyone's got at least one story. So almost everybody's got some story or another, you know, if it's not from their family, it's from a friend's uncle's, you know, best mate or something like that. Everyone has got at least one. And there are still traditions and kind of behaviours which exist today, which are part of that fairy folklore, like refusing to cut down certain trees in the middle of fields. Or you find an old grave, you find bones or something like that, or you find a piece of jewellery in a bog, you leave it. You don't kind of take it away. That these are prevailing kind of traditions that exist to this day. And unlike other mythological creatures like vampires or, you know, other mythological creatures which have a great deal of prevalence in fantasy today, the belief and the traditions that surround fairies are still very relevant and are still used, whereas there aren't actually that many people, at the very least in Britain and in Ireland, who follow traditions against vampires or who follow traditions against werewolves. But fairies remain to this day.
Yeah, I think that's a fair comment. And it's not a case of so much that everybody believes, it's more a case of let's err on the safe side.
Exactly.
Let's not upset local spirits. I think we should clarify what we mean by fairies, because obviously if anyone's been listening to this podcast for any length of time, they'll know that we don't mean the little Victorianised Pinkerbell types or the Cottingley fairy types, but no. Just for anybody who might have joined us just randomly on this 200th episode, obviously welcome, but also we're not talking about cute little pixies here.
No, we are talking about the old Celtic gods, monstrosities who could be nice and could be terrible, and had about kind of like an 80% chance of killing you. And eating you.
There's obviously lots and lots of different types and things, but generally they weren't things that you really wanted to get too involved with.
No.
They weren't pretty little creatures that you sought out particularly, or if you did, you were really stupid.
Yeah.
And I distinctly remember my grandmother warning me on more than one occasion that you didn't have dealings with the Shay.
Yeah.
Word for word, literally, you don't deal with the Shay, my girl.
it makes me think that fairly recently, my partner and I went to Ireland, and we were walking along the beach in Ballycastle, and I leant down to pick up a bit of crystal which was on the beach. The beaches are covered with kind of quartz crystal, tumbled quartz, and it's so beautiful. And I picked a piece up, and my partner, in a very jokey voice, went, "Oh, the Selkie's pearls." And I was like, "That's not a thing." And he's like, "Ah, if you take that, you'll be cursed. You'll be woken in the night by terrible nightmares, and you'll be thrashing, and something will come and slap you across the face, and there'll be thorns in the bed." And he just went on and on and on, and I just put the stone back. And obviously he was 100% joking. But it was just the fact that even though he is joking, these kinds of stories are so prevalent in the mindset of people who've kind of grown up in that area, or who know the area, or, you know, have had any time with me, because I won't shut up about it, that it's still so alive to this day, whether you believe in it or not. And I just really like the fact that, looking particularly at the way that fairies are treated in Ireland and in Scotland compared to how they're treated, particularly in the south of England, and I mean England, so not Wales, not really Cornwall, but the south of England, it's completely different, because in the south of England, they don't really have the same fairy tradition. So the Victorian fairies are the ones that have prevailed. So it's all very flower fairies, granting wishes, you know, these very friendly figures. Whereas anyone who's had that very old folk history that has come through the ages all kind of agrees, fairies may be interesting, but we don't want to actually deal with them. It's kind of like hearing about someone who had a terrible accident, like entertaining from a distance. And when I say entertaining from a distance, you know what I mean. We read the newspaper, we see horrible things, but it's a completely different thing to actually have that occur to you. And you don't seek it out, certainly.
Yeah, it's interesting, because you're right. On the surface, if you look at the south of England, sort of the fairy tradition, there isn't really one. It's very broken, as you say. And you get this Victorianised effect. If you dig a bit below that into the folklore of the area, there are still snatches of it there.
Mm.
And it's so completely different that you would actually not identify it as fairy lore initially, unless you knew better.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's like talking about Wales, you're looking at more like hobs and goblins than fairies. And certainly you're not looking at the Shay as in powerful creatures, in the same sense of the Gaelic traditions.
No.
But the... What was I thinking? Yeah, it's sort of not very far from where I live, sort of over the border. So on the border between Wales and Gloucestershire and Hereford and things, they have what they call Pharisees. And Pharisees, like a dialect word for fairy. And the Pharisees are supposed to bless the apple orchards around that particular area. But if you get on the wrong side of them, bad things happen. And the least of it is your apples going bad on your apple trees. there's quite a lot of stories in the area about people disappearing and then reappearing years later.
Yeah.
But without having physically changed at all. And these are comparatively recent stories. I think one of the most recent dates back to something like 1920, which is comparatively very recent for this sort of story. So it's interesting. There are little pockets around England where these things have still survived despite sort of the Victorianised and Edwardianised of the traditions.
Yeah. But I think it's... I don't actually just think it's the Victorians. I don't want to derail this too much, but I also think that a large part is that, you know, the fairies come from a Celtic tradition, and England has been invaded a lot. So I think that a lot of these stories have remained, but over time they've basically kind of been mixed in with other mythologies and other beliefs. So actually, you see the similarities in fairies as you do with elves, as you do with ghosts and demons and other things like that, which have just kind of taken over. But the stories themselves are eerily similar, and I think it's because they all come from a very similar origin. They've just kind of been mixed up. So I think you're right that actually fairies have remained in the south, but they go by a different name.
Yeah, it is quite difficult. I mean, it's one of the things that most frustrated Tolkien, wasn't it? The fact that we didn't have this great oral tradition of tales, sort of like you'd find in Ireland or Scotland or what have you, hence Lord of the Rings. But it's all, you can piece together the fragments. The fragments are there. And it's certainly a very interesting rabbit hole for folklore to go down.
Yeah.
But we did say we were going to talk about them from the perspective of urban fantasy. So
yes.
Steering us back on course. Why do fairies work as creatures of urban fantasy? And I think it's for the very reason we've been talking about. It doesn't matter how disconnected you are from the whole idea. This body of folklore exists in the zeitgeist. It exists in the common mind, if you like.
Yes.
And it's very easy to create echoes in fantasy for things that people don't even realise they half remember. So that's where they fit so perfectly. There is just this huge tradition of fairies always being sort of brushing up against our mundane lives, if you like.
Mm-hmm.
The chance of this other world being there.
Yeah. And I think that even, you know, alongside with that is the fact that fairies represent something within all of us in a way that potentially other things don't. And they have this relationship with death, and it doesn't actually matter what era they're in. Death is relevant to all of us, and it's relevant to us now. But it's not just death, it's also these kind of very core elements of humanity which exist as part of kind of the fairy. And I think that if we think about what the fairies are and where they came from, and that sense of this other world which is both present and not present, here and not here, it's like the unconscious in a lot of ways. So wherever there are human beings, fairies belong as well. They're like dreams, they're like the other side of us. So I just think that they fit anywhere.
Okay, but from the urban fantasy perspective, yes, we agreed on.
No.
How
okay.
would you fit that in there?
So, in terms of the urban fantasy, when you actually kind of look at what urban fantasy is about, it's set in the modern day, but it's also about kind of dealing with modern ideas. And in a lot of ways, it's a little bit kind of like the Gothic, because it's urban fantasy often sort of relates the old versus the new. With fairies being part of the old, but not just the old, the wild side, the uncontrolled, the ancient, the chaotic, which really, really matters, particularly now in this very sort of meticulous, order-orientated world. And so if you want to create an interesting narrative, having that chaos and the order kind of battling against each other is perfect. And having the modern setting of all of these buildings, where everything feels controlled, it paralleled by this kind of very old, very chaotic sort of figures, it really, really works. And it's also, as I said, that fairies exist where humans exist. They are the unconscious part of us. So they work in urban fantasy. They work in a modern setting. They don't feel out of place.
Yeah. I think there's also something to be said for its wildness versus tameness and nature versus urbanisation.
Yeah, definitely.
As well. There's a sense that we've lost a certain amount of that part of ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And having fairies there in urban fantasy, that's quite often an excellent juxtaposition for either reclaiming it or for having a fey creature existing in a human world and sort of renouncing or acting as like an expatriate from their own sort of environment, I suppose.
Yeah, absolutely.
Let's look at some of the big tropes for putting fairies in urban fantasy.
Okay. So the first one is they're sexy. But then everyone's sexy in urban fantasy.
I was looking at a broader trope than that, but we can start there if you want.
No. Sorry.
My thing is, I've never actually read anything with fairies in and thought, oh yeah, they're sexy. What I generally get from them is, yes, they're supposed to be beautiful creatures most of the time, but that beauty's a weapon. It's terrifying.
Yeah.
It can be used to change what you think and how you feel, but it's not actually there as just a source of pleasure.
No. No, absolutely. What I do mean is that, yeah, very often there is this great emphasis put on them being very, very good looking, particularly whenever there's sort of high fey involved, or the Tuatha De Danann, or the Aeshi, or Shay, as you say. You know, it, whenever kind of one of them is represented, they are always represented as being incredibly good looking, but this dangerous sort of beauty, which is alluring, but, as you say, a weapon. And I don't think I've ever actually really read any kind of urban fantasy where the main fairies are sort of ugly. You have lesser fae who might be creatures and monsters, but the high fae are always depicted as incredibly beautiful and always kind of look young looking. So that's just something which I have found fairly consistent with the urban fantasy that I've seen.
Yeah, I mean, that's taken directly from the Shay.
Yeah.
That tradition, I think, whereby you have all the... all what you would call the High Court Fae are of high human aspect, but more so. They're like so much more than us.
Yeah.
In terms of both physicality, but also... they're almost Shakespearean in the way they feel and react. They don't feel and react in the same way that humans do.
No.
And there's no proportion to it when you finally do get a reaction from them.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
Absolutely, yeah.
So a common bit of lore is the fact that they don't fall in love in the way humans do. As in, it can be absolutely catastrophic. Humans and fae don't mix very well. It's like oil and water.
Yeah.
And it's not going to end well. I mean, I can't think of any actual traditions from the lore where it does genuinely end well. One of them always ends up really upset and either becomes a vengeful goddess or ends up dying. There doesn't seem to be a middle ground.
Yeah, there's no happy endings if you fall in love with one of the she. There's really no happy endings.
So there's that. I think the thing that would be worth looking at from an urban fantasy perspective is the changeling. And this is a nice, in terms of, for a writer, this is a nice trope, because you can have someone who is otherworldly but not too otherworldly and is human but still fairly might have some minor powers, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
So you've got a main character who doesn't fit in either world and can act as the bridge between both of them.
Yes. It is...
And I think you can either... Sorry, carry on.
No, go on.
I was going to say, you can either act as like the classic hero's journey, where this person hasn't really discovered that they're a changeling. They've always thought they were subtly weird, and they discover what they really are. And it's a quest for identity. And almost all hero's journeys are a quest for identity in some form or another.
Mm-hmm.
Or you can have it that they've always known and always had to hide what they are and been rejected by both sides. And, you know, you can deal with some very real world issues by looking at it from that perspective.
Yeah, absolutely. The changeling one has always interested me, because within the folklore, changelings themselves are not actually baby fairies. They are fully grown fairies that can speak. And a changeling doesn't actually have to be a child either. It could be an adult. So there has kind of always been this, that side that we don't really tend to see that, a lot of that in urban fantasy. And I don't actually necessarily mind that, because the idea is really, really, really interesting. This perception of being not what you are perceived to be, and this question of belonging as well, which I think is very relevant nowadays, particularly, and actually probably always has been. There's a big link between sort of autism and changelings, the idea that actually that might be what caused people to believe that they had changeling children, in that their children were not acting in the way that they expected children to be acting. So I also think that, you know, having the changeling storyline is a great way to explore people who are different, who are born different, and don't necessarily and feel that they don't belong in the rest of society, or feel like there's something preventing them from entering the rest of society, which I think a lot of people to some degree do feel at some point. But particularly for minority groups, it's a fascinating angle to be able to tell a story from.
And who doesn't like a good changeling story?
Absolutely.
In the sense of, certainly in the examples I've seen in young adult fiction, for example, it tends to have been a fairy child swapped with a human child at birth for nefarious reasons.
Yeah.
Which then, once the children have reached a stage of maturity, sort of 16, 17 years old, all becomes apparent. And it's usually not good.
No.
Honestly, there's not a good reason for doing this, or not a worthy reason.
No.
But it does make for a very good story. And I have seen examples whereby, you know, this is, again, directly out of the folklore, where a changeling child was left in place of a human child, and nobody can tell it's a changeling child except one person. That one person has to then journey into the other world to get their real brother or sister or niece or whatever back.
Yeah.
Which, again, is a classic quest story. So, I mean, urban fantasy and fairies are so adaptable to all these classic storylines.
Yeah.
Which I think is partly why it's so, you know, it's so prolific. If you just pop on Amazon and put in urban fantasy fairies, you will get a slew of results. And I've read quite a few, and I've read a lot of the big ones, and I've read some of the smaller sort of indie published ones, who, by the way, are doing very nicely off of writing these books, because there is such a huge market for them. People love their stories.
Yeah.
They love fairies in their stories. So it's just really interesting, because, I mean, I had a quick look this morning, and I think there was something like 60 authors I'd never heard of who were clearly doing very, very well off the back of it. It's just a bit of an eye-opener as to how prevalent that sort of archetype and adapting those storylines really is.
Yeah. Absolutely.
So, other tropes.
Yes.
Other tropes. Basically, the idea of the other world. So you're in your mundane world, perhaps you've got a job as a waitress and you're studying part-time or something. You've had a pretty boring life, perhaps a few family issues or something.
Mm-hmm.
And then suddenly, bang, you end up, I don't know, perhaps you find this suspiciously beautiful man who's been shot through the leg with an arrow who can't draw it out himself. So you, being the curious person you are and wanting a break from your mundane life, you agree to help, and you realise he can't touch the arrow because the arrow is made of iron. So you help draw the arrow, etc., and then he's like, well, I now owe you 3 questions, kind of thing. And it goes on from there, and it's the sudden revelation of this other world that's always been there, and the fact that they fight their wars on our borders.
Yeah.
So occasionally their own squabbles spill over into the human world. And there's, you know, if you knew which fairy mound to go to and which knight to appear on and what to say to the creature on the door, then you can go to these places too.
Yeah.
I think this works really well when it's layered with the human world, in the sense of they've almost fully integrated. So there are these places, and glamour makes them look like human places. It looks like an average club, but you're actually going under the hill, as it were.
Yeah.
I really love that as a trope. That really works for me.
Now, I really, really like it too. And the thing I really like as well is when you have that sense of the uncanny, which is that everything is almost exactly the same, and then there's just one or two things which are completely different. which kind of snap you back to the reality of kind of where you are, and that this is a dangerous place. And I think that it's also very popular because it means that your main character can almost be kind of lulled into a false sense of security before being reminded that they're not on Earth. These are, you know, this is not what they're used to. This is an entirely different society with different rules, different morals, different understandings. And I just think that that works brilliantly.
Definitely. I think it's especially good at exposing some of the more horrific sides of where human morality is compromised.
Yeah.
So, for example, it's generally accepted that we don't kill each other, you know, if we can avoid it. So going somewhere, perhaps going to a club and it turns out to be the Unseelie Court or something, and it's fine for fairies to rip each other apart if they can do in the name of entertainment.
Yeah.
That's a sudden real slap in the face, and it's not a little thing, but it's like, oh my god.
Yeah.
And at the same time, accepting a gift from somebody there, we might think little of that as humans in a human world. But in a fairy context, accepting a gift confers an obligation. You could be swearing yourself to a lifetime of slavery to that person. So it's all these little pitfalls and traps and things, and being completely fish out of water with the whole thing.
Yeah, absolutely. It's also simple as saying things like thank you.
Yeah, it's a binding contract. Yeah. You don't say thank you to. They don't like that. They don't like that because you're suggesting that they then owe you something.
Yeah, exactly. Or that you owe them something.
All those stories of someone doing, you know, a good deed, bandaging a fairy's finger or something, and then the next morning they find their barn has been absolutely full to overflowing with corn or what have you. It's like, no, they don't like obligation. Obligation then gets firmly shoved back onto the person who unwittingly gave it to them in the first place.
Yeah.
And it's not done out of a sense of goodness or gratitude or anything. It's done because they really don't want to owe you anything.
Yeah. So basically, don't go into fairy. Seriously, don't go into fairy.
I mean, urban fantasy is great for this idea of there being an underworld, if you like. It is our world. It's just shades of our world that we don't see. And then once your eyes are opened, you've had that shatter glass moment and you cannot unsee it. I like it when there's a little bit more, and it's a case of, no, you can literally step between worlds with the two.
Yeah.
That works for me as well.
I also like the general imagery of it as well, because with fairies, we have so often associated them with nature. And it's also, I think, really about their environment. They are part of the environment, so they are, you know, intrinsically linked to nature. That, you know, when we think of the fairy world, we sort of imagine this very Lord of the Rings-esque place. You know, and so suddenly having this complete opposite of fairies going clubbing, of fairies, you know, in these very sort of modern settings, it's intriguing. It feels new and interesting because it goes against what we perceived they were going to be like. And for me, it also kind of highlights their unpredictability as well. Because actually, fairies, you know, love music, they love dancing, they love kind of partying it up, they really enjoy that kind of stuff. So yeah, if a few of them got a taste for modern music, I can totally see them slipping into nightclubs and things like that, and having a whale of a time.
Let's look at some of our favourite urban fantasy fairy examples.
Okay.
I've got quite a lot here. Apparently I read a lot of fairy urban fantasy. I'd never really have thought of that, but if I look back over the last 10 years, I've read a lot. First one is an odd example, because I think most people would consider it more of an example of sort of slightly more epic fantasy. But it's a favourite from childhood, and that's Alan Garner's The Weird Stone of Brisingamen, which doesn't have Shay in and doesn't have fairies as we see in other urban fantasy, but it does have the Laius Alpha, who are the elves of light. And it does have the two children, Colin and Susan, stumbling in on this entire world of gods and monsters and fairies, alongside from out to the edge. And, you know, the Svartalfheim, the goblin creatures that come out of the quarries at night and abduct people. And it's like, no, that feels very fairy urban fantasy to me, even now. Even the way it's written, going back and reading it again, that's epic fantasy meets urban fantasy. And I don't think I've read anybody who's quite captured it in the same way. It's folk horror, I think, as well.
Yeah.
So Alan Garner is definitely a master at blending all these things together.
Yeah. But I mean, also, I think the other thing that really indicates that there is sort of, it's fairies, is that it is linked to the Arthurian mythos as well.
Yeah, and the Nordic.
Yeah, and the Nordic, which, again, we've talked about this kind of this marriage of mythologies, which he's kind of really managed to capture very well. But you're right, I do think it's definitely fairies, just fairies by a different name, of which there are many, many, many examples all across the world.
Yeah, I mean, you've got the Morrigan turning up, for example. And I think if I'd read that book, I read it when I was 7 the first time. It's a creepy book for a 7-year-old. I mean, it's pretty creepy if you're 12. There are parts of that book that even now I'm a bit sort of, ooh, that's an uncomfortable thing. but if I'd known a bit more about the Morrigan when I was 7, I would have found that book terrifying. And she was pretty scary in the book for the first time round.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So, next, I kind of want to talk about a book that you're very fond of, Jules, actually, which is The Whitby Witches.
Ah, yes.
Now,
that was an interesting choice because I didn't think of that as fairies, but you've kind of got a point there. I think I see where you're going.
Yeah. So The Whitby Witches, obviously set in Whitby. It's not quite modern day anymore. But it's modern enough, as it were. And they're merfolk, aren't they?
Yeah, the Alvoiders.
Yeah. Who I thought they were fairies.
Well, they do certainly fill that niche, don't they?
They do. They're water fairies, but that, you know, that doesn't change anything at all. You know, the way that their sort of societies function, this old sense of the old magic, the old traditions, the curses, the, you know, even the fact that they just, the way they age, it feels very fae-like. And I like it in particular because it links in fairies and witches, tickles me. Sorry, it tickles me.
No, and it does work, and there is definitely a link there that there always has been, in the sense of, you know, witches supposedly communing more with nature and fairies being sort of embodiments of particular parts of nature. I mean, the Alfweders are really interesting because they are this entire, well, they've hidden from human sight so long that humans have forgotten how to see them. So most of the time they're left alone. Nobody can see them anymore. Unless you happen to be one of the rare people who has the sight, then you can see them, and they tend to find you dangerous. And in true fairy tradition, elf waiters who find a human with the sight are technically supposed to kill them. Just like fairies are supposed to blind humans with the sight so that they couldn't be seen. Because they didn't really care for that. They didn't like their glamours being pierced so easily.
Yeah.
But the elf waiters, they're also, they're sort of representative of a time past, you know, a time when in Whitby livings were made almost entirely through fishing, and they represent the old fishing families that you can still find in places like Portland, where there's a very particular relationship with the sea, and there's particular traditions and things that won't make a lot of sense to anybody who hasn't come from that background, but are sort of eerie and beautiful at the same time. And, you know, Madden's right, they are kind of water fairies, but they're fairies in the sense of more like trolls. You know, they're small and they're wrinkled and squat and, you know, quite well built because they have to be to withstand the cold. They live in the caves and the cliffs and things, so they're definitely interesting.
Yeah, I certainly saw them kind of like Fomori, really.
Yeah, I think that's pretty apt.
Yeah. So that's the Whitby Witches. It's another really good example of fairies that go by a different name.
Okay, I'll come in with another one. I realised that, you know, if I actually was nerdy enough to do... to do a spreadsheet of what I've read this year and then to create pie charts, probably a large chunk of that pie chart would be taken up by Seanan Maguire's back catalogue. I've read all 13 books and a lot of the short stories in the October Day series this year. October Day is basically a private investigator, but she's a changeling. So when you start off with the first book, Rosemary and Rue, she has just... she's trying to leave everything behind. She's trying to turn her back on fairy. She is trying to live as a human, even though she'll outlive most humans. Most changelings live sort of 250 years. She's lost contact with her daughter because while she was working for one of the fairy lords, she's one of his sworn knights, she got too close to something and got turned into a fish for 14 years. And of course, humans tend to age, so when she came back, she'd missed 14 years of her daughter's life, and her daughter wanted to have nothing to do with her. So you're already starting from a position of, this is really, really painful. And it goes on from there, and you just sort of follow Toby as she ends up being drawn back into fairy far more, because fairy needs somebody who can represent the humans to them, and the humans need someone who can intercede for them with fairy. And that's essentially what October ends up doing, or Toby ends up doing. She finds out a lot more about her heritage, and she becomes a lot more fae as she goes along. So the later books are a lot more to do with her struggling to hold on to her humanity, even though her father's been dead for about 60 years.
That sounds really, really interesting.
They're really, really good books.
Okay, so I don't think we can really proceed without me mentioning the Dresden Files.
No, that's fair.
So the Dresden Files actually uses fairies in a number of different ways. And the first time that we actually are introduced to fairies, we're introduced to these much, they're lesser fairies. They're kind of like...
I've just gone to Pizza Lord.
Yes, it's the Pizza Lord. Exactly right.
I love that.
Which it's brilliant, which is that... basically, Harry can call upon little sort of fairies to help him out with certain things like finding people, and he bribes them with pizza. And it works quite well. And he gains one's loyalty, and then he has a kind of little swarm who kind of know him as the Pizza Lord because he just gives them copious amounts of pizza. And that's our first introduction to fairies in the Dresden Files. And then as the story progresses, you start to see these other fairies, and two courts are established. You have the Seely Court and the Unseely Court. It's the Winter Court and the Summer Court. Is that right?
Yes, that's right.
Yeah. And he sort of, he kind of has dealings with both of them, and they're terrifying, and they're full of sort of high fae and wild fae, of all sorts of descriptions, of course, of which the little fairies that Dresden has been using are part of that as well. And Dresden also has a fairy godmother.
Yep.
Who is Elenanshi, or Lenanshi? How do you say it?
Oh, so it was Lanshi. It's not really two syllables, but I mean, depends dialect wise.
I wouldn't say she's nice. She's certainly helpful at times.
Yeah.
But yeah, as is the case with the Dresden Files, any of the women, of which there are quite a few, in the fairy court. You have obviously the queen of the winter court and the queen of the summer court and their daughters, and then yeah, a few others. They're all very sexy. They're all very good looking in rather typical Harry Dresden fashion.
I'm gonna say,
he is surrounded by very sexy women.
I think that's more of a Jim Butcher thing. I mean, I was going to say something then that was a bit snarky and it's not really necessary, so I'm not going to say it, but I think that's as much a reflection of the author as the actual folklore. But they are good, and you have to give Butcher credit for the fact that he's blended the worlds quite seamlessly. He's got a multi-layered underworld for his urban fantasy series there, and it does work.
He does. Some of those old ideas, like not being able to lie, in quite interesting ways. So I quite like it, actually, how he's handled fairies.
Another one, I've mentioned Holly Black a fair bit recently because I'd recently finished her most... How many times can I say recent in a sentence? I've most recently finished her recent trilogy. Oh, God. Anyway.
Recently,
yeah. It was quite recent, in fact. She writes great young adult urban fantasy with fairies. She has the nickname the Queen of the Fairies. And her fairies are nasty, very nasty. Her original trilogy, Modern Fairy Tales, comprises of Tithe, which is a clever Tamlin retelling, Valiant, mm-hmm. which sort of is set in the same world but doesn't directly follow on, although you do get glimpses of the characters, and Ironside, because the fairies call the human world Ironside, so if you're being sent Ironside, you're being sent into exile where there's iron and smoke and things in the air and it will poison you and gradually you will die.
That's really cool. Not the dying part, but the idea of it, that's very cool.
And what's really interesting is that her characters are not good or bad, they're very conflicted. She nearly always has a female lead, and they are very conflicted in what they do. They make bad choices a lot of the time, but ultimately the better parts of their natures eventually assert themselves. This most recent trilogy, The Folk of the Air, was all told from Jude Duarte's perspective, and as I mentioned in a previous episode, she and her twin sister and her older sister were all taken into fairy by the Red Cap, who killed their parents in front of them because it was their duty to raise them.
Again, a Red Cap. A Red Cap. Why a Red Cap?
Well, yeah, it's like, why would you... Of all the fairies that you could decide to have an affair with as a mortal, a Red Cap's a really, really bad idea. And then to then cheat on this Red Cap with a human smith who'd also been abducted into fairy and disappear, taking his children with you, that's a really, really bad idea.
It's a terrible, terrible idea. Like an eye-wateringly bad idea.
But I mean, it's really interesting because you would think that Jude would grow up hating her father, her fairy father, her fairy stepfather, if you like, who had killed her human father and mother in front of her. And she does hate that thing about him, but she never stops remembering what he was. She actually grows to love and respect him because he's very kind to the children and he raises them as if they were his own. He introduces them as if they were his own children. And he does what he can to protect them, even though they're pretty much terrified the entire time because they can't fully protect themselves from the fairies that they're basically being sent to school with.
Yeah.
She never forgets that he's a Red Cap, that his inclination is to blood and slaughter and to then, you know, re-dye his cap in the blood of the person he's just killed. And the fact that he probably did that with her mother, and yet she learns from him. She learns everything. So it's a very complicated relationship.
Yeah, definitely. It sounds really, really, really interesting. And I've definitely got this on my to-read list.
They are worth reading. A lot of people have said they didn't like the old trilogy, the Modern Fairy Tales, but they've really loved The Folk of the Air. I love them both in different ways. And then there's an interim standalone book called The Darkest Part of the Forest, which again, it's a pair of twins who, they live in this one town in America where everybody knows that the fair folk are nearby and that you need to be careful. And the rest of the world sees it as kind of a tourist attraction. And the fairies prey on the tourists who come in. The agreement is that they won't touch the people who actually are native to the town. And things go really, really pear-shaped there. I mean, the main character, Hazel, has always wanted to be a knight, and she sort of realises pretty early on in the story that she doesn't know what's been going on when she goes to sleep. She's got a pretty shrewd idea that perhaps she's not actually staying in her bed all night, but she can't remember anything. And she does have this horrible feeling because she did once swear an oath to a fairy lord. She said he could have 7 years of her life. And she thought, oh, he'll take 7 years off the end of my life. What will I care? I'm 14. I've got loads of time to live. Of course, they don't necessarily take time sequentially. So it gets very interesting.
That's really, really interesting. Okay, these are definitely on my to read list now.
They're definitely up your street, I would say. Right, before we go, we can have a brief flirtation with how we've used fairies in our own work.
Yes. So obviously, fairies become quite prominent in your unveil at the end.
Yes. And I've almost gone directly from Irish mythology. I've gone from Shay lore. I've gone from the stories my grandmother used to tell me. So some ways, perhaps I haven't been massively imaginative, although I did quite enjoy having them manoeuvre through the human world for those few bits that they needed to, because really they haven't changed their perspective. They've just relied on the fact that people have forgotten who they are.
Yeah, absolutely. And I really like the way that actually there's been this mix of the old and the new. And just the idea that the fairies haven't really moved because they can't move, because they are deathless, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So they haven't progressed because they have no need to progress. It's like they're standing still. And yet at the same time, they are still touching on this rapidly moving world. I loved the kind of the way that you did that, and the sense of unease that kind of wormed its way through because of that.
Yeah, it's the fact that they're working on different time frames as well. So
yeah,
our time and their time line up with the great fire festivals, but the rest of the time it can get quite loopy, and you can be there for, I don't know, 3 days, and it turns into 3 weeks for you.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
And again, okay, I suppose I have done the whole, I suppose to a certain extent I've done the sexy fairy thing. But I think it's always terrifying. I don't think there's ever a moment where you're thinking, oh, this is titillating. I think it's just a case of, no, this is terrifying. They've got all the power. They are incredibly rapey. It's turned into a competition for this, well, for Kieran's kind of attention. He's become a toy, a pet, or worse. And it's just really, really disturbing.
Yeah. It is. And it's not just on a physical level either. It's an emotional level, a psychological level as well. And there's no sense of rest either. Kieran can't rest because it's just constantly around him. It was very tense, and I really, really liked that. Even in terms of the kind of the allies that Emmeline gets, you feel like you can't 100% trust them, and you're not really supposed to.
Yeah, their nature is that, well, they're helping because they're balancing obligations, largely.
Yeah.
And they might not have any great problem with Emmeline or with Aoife or Sorica, who is with them. But at the same time, if you caught them on another day, they might have made another decision. They're very, they're whimsical in the true sense of the word, and true whimsy has a certain amount of eeriness and an unsettled feeling to it.
Yeah, absolutely. There was just very much this sense of another world, another rule, and other rules, but not just, it's the rules of nature itself, and the rules of mannerisms and behaviour and things like that. And fairies do actually follow their own rules to the letter, usually. It's just that those rules don't necessarily make sense to us.
Yeah. You've obviously used fairies a little bit in Hamartia's Cycle, which is an urban fantasy, but I know you're also using them to some extent in Kestrel. Are you willing to tell us a bit about that? No spoilers, obviously. I'm trying not to put you in a position, but
yeah. So there are fairies which are used in Kestrel, and hopefully as the series progresses, the fairies kind of will become more prominent. Because obviously this is set in the same world as Unveiled, it's a very similar principle, which is that kind of the fairy world sort of exists parallel to the human world, a little bit outside of time, and it has that very unknowing quality. Of course, Kestrel's experience in the fairy world is rather different to Emmeline's experience in the fairy world, simply because of her background. Emmeline is of course the handmaiden of death, so she's basically being rejected constantly.
Yeah,
and there she is, whereas it's kind of a little bit the opposite for Kestrel, who is to some extent welcomed into fairy and has these very sort of weird sensations of sort of swinging between feeling very kind of sort of like she should be there, like very welcomed, and then suddenly going, oh God, no, I definitely need to get out, because obviously she's very much been raised in the human world. But it's been brilliant, brilliant fun writing about her experiences sort of in fairy, but also her experiences the first time she encounters High Fae, and she's basically absolutely terrified, and she can't see who's around her the first time she encounters them, and she's basically kind of got her head between her knees going, please not High Fae, please not High Fae, oh God, it's High Fae.
Very sensible, in fairness.
Yeah, and she basically has this experience of basically trying to explain what it's like for her to hear the fairies speaking. And it's just totally overwhelming, because they don't actually have glamour at that point. So her meagre senses are basically trying to understand this humongous, the whole magnitude of their voices, their scent, their everything, and her brain can barely sort of piece it all together. So I'm kind of writing about that. So I'm looking forward to doing a little bit more as Kestrel encounters more fairies in the future.
Can't wait to read it.
says Jules.
Yes, hint, Kestrel. Yeah, basically, that's the only sensible reaction to have when faced with High Shay. And I think Em's reaction is pretty similar, to be honest.
She wasn't. She. It was even harder for Em, though.
Yeah.
dearie me. Anyway, thank you for indulging me today.
Will that last for another year, do you think?
No. But but we'll try. So once again, I'd just like to thank all of our listeners for helping us get to 200 episodes. It's unbelievable. I'm so glad and amazed that you're still listening and hanging on, and that we've seemed to have gained more listeners as well, because obviously this is possible without you. So thank you for putting up with my fairy chatter for 200 episodes.
Yes, thank you.
Before we go, it is time for our Dissecting Dragons recommendation of the week. Yes. And this week I've got one. So I recently went to see Frozen 2, which is very different to the first movie. Well worth going to see, definitely. It's a very interesting sequel. Completely different in the way that it's kind of pieced together. Visually, it is stunning, and there are some beautiful ideas there and some really lovely kind of chilling music. It doesn't feel as catchy as the first movie, and it's not as light as the first movie, but there are some very funny bits as well and some very interesting characters there. So definitely worth seeing if you enjoyed the first one, and actually kind of relevant to what we've discussed today in terms of fairies. There's a little bit of kind of a sense of that as well in this film. So check it out, guys. And I'm going to say thanks very much for listening. Us next week.
Yeah, thanks and goodbye.
Bye!
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders, or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note that no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.